we're not the first people to try to look for the essence of Bhagavad Gita or the essence of anything. This is something that's been, as we were talking about last time, this has been an attempt by all of our acharyas to find the essence of whatever they're reading and whatever they're studying. And so, thousands of years ago, literally 2,000 years or more, a group of philosophers called the Mimamsakas, they developed a system for finding the essence from any kind of book. How do you find the main point or the meaning of any text that you're studying? And this was a system that perhaps you remember if you attended my seminar on glories of Srimad Bhagavatam in 2010. But this is a system that's used then after that by most of the acharyas, from Shankaracharya to Madhvacharya to our own Shirajiva Goswami, who uses it in his Sandarbhas. And the system is called Shad Tatparya Linga, which means the six indicators of meaning. Okay. So the basic question is this. If someone gives you a book at random, okay, and you're trying to figure out what the main point of that book is, what's the main point that the author is trying to convey, then how do you determine what that main point is, what the main purport is of a book? So the technique says that you look at six different things within a book, okay, in order to determine its meaning. The first thing you look at, and does everyone have access to a pen and a piece of paper? Or if you don't have it, then at least the person sitting next to you should have it. Here, huh? Okay. Maybe someone can distribute this. Yeah, anything. Yeah, if you have an iPad, that's also okay. Yeah, as long as someone around you has it, that's enough. You can share with them. And you don't need a whole pad, you just need a couple pieces of paper. Can a couple people distribute? Maybe two people? Otherwise this will take a whole evening. Hand a stack to someone else and then they can help pass it out. So if you received a book and you wanted to figure out what it actually means, what the main point of the author is, right, where would you look in the book first? Yeah, you look at something in the beginning, right? The introduction. The author often says what he or she is intending to write about in the introduction or in the preface or somewhere near the beginning. So these six indicators of meaning, okay? Now write these down. Or have someone next to you write it down. First is the introduction. What is the main point being made by the author in the introduction? And then you also look at the other side of the book, namely the conclusion. Usually the author will start off on the introduction saying this is what we plan to accomplish, and then in the conclusion, they'll go back over whatever was written to say, look, this is what we accomplished. So they set out their aims and objectives, and then come back to it at the end. So you look at the introduction and the conclusion, and the meaning of the two should match. Okay, there should be unity there between the introduction and the conclusion. So those two things together actually forms one of the six indicators, even though it's two, but unity of the introduction and conclusion is the first one. Okay. Then the second indicator of meaning is what is repeated. If an author repeats some point over and over again in a book, or a teacher does that, then you know, oh, that's probably the main point of the book. Right? Or that's an important point, at least. Repetition. So then next thing you check, number two, is what's being repeated on a regular basis. Third thing, what is new in the book? What's original? What's novel? Every book has a reason for being written. The author always has some reason for writing it, even if it's a topic that 100 people have written about. When you write a book or anything, you say, the reason I'm writing this book is because there's no such book out there yet. This book offers something unique, something distinctive about my subject. It's the first time it's being presented like this, or whatever it is. Then you look for what's new in the book, what's unique. What does the author say is new? Okay. Third. Number four is what's the fruit or the result of studying that book? In today's education, it's often very popular to lay out aims and objectives right from the start. So, what does the author say you should be able to do by the end of this course, by the end of this book? You should be able to, 1, 2, 3. So, what is the phalam, it's called? So, each one of these has a Sanskrit name. Upakrama, upasanghara, abhyasa, apurvata, and then phalam. What is the fruit? Then, number five is what is praised. What does the author wax eloquent about? What is the author really excited about? What does he praise, or what does she describe in flowing language? Saying, really, this is the best thing. Because the author's enthusiasm for something is also a good indicator that this is the primary meaning. So this is called arthavada. What is the object of praise? And then the last one is upapatti, which means the argument, reasoning. What is the argument being presented? How does the author get to the point, the main point? What's the logic that leads there? So the idea is that if you can find some idea which is shown by all six points, then that idea must be the main point of the book. Okay? So in other words, say we're doing this, we're using this on Bhagavad Gita, and I want to prove, right? This is a method of proof, I want to prove that the main point of Bhagavad Gita is you should enjoy as much sense gratification as possible. Okay? This is my goal. Enjoy your senses. This is Krishna's main point. So I look in the introduction, and I say, oh, Krishna is saying enjoy your senses in the introduction. Let's enjoy. Arjun, why don't you enjoy the kingdom? He says, go out and fight and then enjoy the kingdom, he says. So this is introduction. Then in the conclusion, again, Krishna is saying you should enjoy. If I can show introduction, conclusion, Krishna is saying enjoy your senses, then what is Krishna repeating over and over in Bhagavad Gita? Enjoy your senses, enjoy your senses, enjoy your senses, right? Okay, three things down. Then, if I can show that what is new in the Bhagavad Gita, for the first time, the Gita is a text which teaches us how to enjoy our senses. And all of other books say you should control your senses, but Bhagavad Gita is unique. It shows us how to enjoy our senses. So that's novelty. And then the fruit of reading Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says clearly, you become the best sense enjoyer. Like that. So you say, and then sixth one, the argument. Why does Krishna think sense enjoyment is the best? Now here's the argument he gives. In the following three verses, he gives the argument. And so suppose I can show that all six things that we listed, actually there's seven, if you count the introduction, conclusion. Right? If you list all of those things, and they all show that sense enjoyment is the goal of life, then we know that that is the main purport of Bhagavad Gita. You see? All six have to match. Now you can choose anything you like, as long as you can prove that all it's corroborated by all of these seven items. Now, a few things about applying this technique. When we say the introduction, it doesn't have to be the very, very first verse. There's flexibility given here. It means it should be somewhere in the introduction. How you define the introduction is a little flexible. Is it the first verse of Bhagavad Gita? Is it the first time Krishna speaks? Is it the first time Krishna speaks as Guru? We talked about this yesterday, right? First time Krishna speaks as Guru. Okay, but you don't want to get too far. Not like in the middle of the book. It has to be introduction, okay? But some flexibility. Conclusion, again, doesn't have to be the very last verse. It can be, you can define conclusion a little more flexibly. Okay. What's repeated? If you can find verses that are repeated, or if you can find some point that's repeated, maybe the language is not repeated constantly, but some point is being repeated, then repetition is okay. You can show it through choosing two, three, four different verses which show a clear repetition of content. And so on. Apurvata, Phalam. What is being praised? What is Krishna excited about? What is he praising? And finally, the argument. Okay, where does Krishna provide an argument proving whatever point you want to prove? So here's the task at hand. Okay, we've received an overview of Bhagavad Gita. We've talked about the first of these four essential verses. And what I want you to do now, before we sort of progress further in this area, is to take the Bhagavad Gita yourselves. We'll break up into groups, okay? Groups of, say, six people. We break up into groups, and we choose, in your group, choose some thesis, some point that you want to prove is the main point of Bhagavad Gita. Okay? You have to choose anything you like. Maybe Krishna is the Supreme Lord. Sense gratification is the best thing. Whatever you like. Choose one point. And then come up with the verses in all these six, seven categories to prove your point. Okay? And all seven categories have to be pointing out what you're trying to show, what you're trying to prove. So what this does is it helps us work with the Gita and see if we can understand sort of the full range of what's happening. Record all of those. Then what I'll do is I'll call on a few groups. We'll do this randomly. I'll call on a few groups. We won't have time for everyone clearly to present. But I'll call on a few groups to present their findings, what they think the main point is. Okay? And then I and the rest of us can serve as devil's advocate. Okay? We'll try to argue against them and say, look, you missed this point. You said that's the introduction, but actually just the next verse, Krishna contradicts that. So you don't have to accept anything someone says. You can then argue back. So I'll serve as devil's advocate, okay? A couple of things. We need a few groups to volunteer to come up with bad arguments, okay? What that means is you prove something that's against our Siddhanta, against the proper view that's accepted by Srila Prabhupada and by our acharyas. Okay? Just so we can see how the Gita can be misinterpreted. Okay? This is also a big learning experience. Most people actually don't understand the essence of Bhagavad Gita. It's very difficult to get. And so what are ways in which we can misunderstand Gita? And how can you prove it? The impersonalists, the Mayavadis have excellent arguments for proving their interpretation is right. So some group, for example, should take an impersonalist point of view as their main point. Someone else can take materialism. And then most of us can do something good, okay? Something positive. Another request is that this area seems to be full of devotees mostly, experienced, initiated devotees. So I request if you can please spread out into the crowd so that every group should have someone who's read the Bhagavad Gita, the whole thing. That way it's a little easier for everyone to work and everyone to learn. So not that all the Bhaktishasti students get together in one in one group, okay? So we try to spread out, especially the devotees here, if you can move from your locations and head out there also, and then everyone can. So 5-6 people in a group, whatever's comfortable, if you turn around, and write these down on a notepad, and make sure you choose one person as your spokesperson in case we call on your group, okay? We'll take about 20 minutes to do this.
Should I stop it?
Okay, good.
Thank you. That's not the first. I can do that right now. You know, we can build a whole argument.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to go to the next one. Thank you. Confidential knowledge. That's what we like to do. Thank you.
I can tell everyone's having a wonderful time with some really animated discussions, arguing about this point and that point, which is exactly the point of this exercise, is to absorb ourselves in Bhagavad Gita. But if I can request you to conclude your deliberations now, and we'll come back together. If one of your categories is not done yet, don't worry. We have a large group of devotees, and we will help you on the spot to fill out your sixth category or fourth one or whatever. And then, only then will we argue against you. Okay? So, Hare Krishna. Everyone, if you can turn around this way again and calm down. Shanti, shanti, shanti. Okay, so first of all, I just want to go through the entire room, and one person from each group just state the main thesis that you're trying to prove, okay? So, no explanation, no arguments, just say it in one sentence what the main point that you were trying to prove is, okay? That way we get a full range of different things. Let's start in this corner and then we'll head around the room like this, okay? So start here with this first group and say it loudly. We won't use the mic for this one here. We'll wait for the mic. This will be quick.
The goal of life is to be one with everything.
Okay, the goal of life is to be one with everything. Okay, excellent.
To understand we're one with everything.
To understand we're one with everything.
The theme was become my devotee.
Okay, become my devotee. Yes.
Krishna is the greatest politician.
Krishna is the greatest politician. That's an original one. Yes. One must perform action and renounce the results. This is probably the most common understanding of the essence of the Gita. Very good. Yes. Oh, we've got two impersonalist camps here. Okay. Excellent. In the back? Krishna will deliver us from this material bondage. Very nice. Perform your duty, but do it as an offering to me. Good.
Bhakti is the highest.
Bhakti is the highest.
Why we should be fully devoted.
Why we should be fully devoted.
Krishna is the supreme.
Krishna is the supreme personality of Godhead. Good. The goal of life is to serve humanity. Excellent. Very good.
Surrender unto me. Surrender unto Krishna.
Surrender unto Krishna. Okay. Good. Yes. Oh, sorry. Okay, I reside, or Krishna resides within everyone's heart. Yes.
Surrender unto Krishna.
Surrender unto Krishna. We've got two groups there. Good. Anyone left? Yes.
All paths do not lead to the same destination.
All paths do not lead to the same destination. Okay. Yes. Do your duty and don't expect the results. Okay, good. There. So we're seeing them coalesce. Now people are sort of heading in different, different general areas. So let's start with, where shall we start? The negative or the positive?
Negative.
Okay. Okay, so let's take a youth group here. We've got a couple youth group. We've got a girls' youth group and a boys' youth group. So we'll take both of them. We'll try to get a couple boys' groups and a couple girls' groups before we end, okay? So let's start with this group here. Yours was impersonalism, right? We're one with everything. And the other group that did impersonalism, please do help them out, okay? If they ever... Okay. Now, whoever's the spokesperson for the group, if you can please stand here so that everyone can see you clearly.
Oh my God.
Okay, stand here. Whoever's going to do the talking, please stand here.
We're all one.
The one with everyone group handed it to another group.
Since we are in this world, we are under the material energy. That's why we are different. Otherwise, we are all one.
Okay, good, good. Okay, so you can stay standing. Everyone can see you.
Standing.
Yeah. Okay, so what you need to do in every group, right? We have to keep this relatively brief, so no long lectures or talks. What you have to do is, you've given our thesis already, just go through the 6 categories and tell us what your verse is, or 2 verses, whatever you have in that category, okay? And don't just give verse numbers, give us what that verse says, because a lot of people may not know what the verse number talks about, okay? So,
okay. Thank you. So the introduction for this topic is in the Bhagavad Gita text, in the 2nd chapter, when Krishna first starts speaking about how the soul is. In the conclusion of that section, Krishna says, Ashcharyavat pashyati kashyadenam. One sees the soul as amazing. Some hears of him as amazing. Some describe him as amazing. But even after describing, no one knows what the soul is like. So, nobody knows what the soul is like. So, it cannot have any form. Then the repetition is found everywhere in the Bhagavad Gita. Throughout the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna uses word Brahman. In the 2nd chapter, towards the end, 272, Krishna says that one who attains this this state of consciousness at the end of his life will attain Brahman Nirvana, will merge into the Brahman. Then we have so many verses that says that. We have 519. Get to the 519. Okay. In the 519, Krishna says, those whose minds are established in sameness and equanimity and already conquered the condition of birth and death, they are flawless like Brahman. And thus they are already situated in Brahman. So, similarly, in 15.8, Krishna says that soul moves from one body to another, like aroma is going from one body to another. Aroma is taken by air. So aroma doesn't have any form. That means like we don't have any form. And then...
What category are you on?
We are in the repetition.
Okay.
Right now. And
that's logic.
Repetition and the logic of the our reason. So now at the this is being praised by Krishna that like one who attains this kind of impersonal liberation will not be lamenting or hankering Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma na shochati na kankshati. One who attains that's in the 14th chapter. So that, one comes, everyone is hankering and lamenting in this world, but if we one attains the impersonal liberation, will be free from hankering and lamentation, free from all kinds of misery. And So in the second chapter also, this logic is given that like those who are resolute in this path, 241, that says that their aim is one. They are striving to become one. And finally, the conclusion of this is in the 1865 and 1866. Krishna says that, always think, like, you know, Krishna says that the idea behind the whole logic is that, like, when Krishna says, come to me, think of me, that means that this is not Krishna the person, but this is something, the spirit within Krishna. Yes, Krishna says, abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me, and I will make you liberated. I'll give you moksha. Moksha ishyami. So 1866, it's like you will become liberated. You will, no, there is no need for religion, there is no need for any differences. Ultimately, he says, Mame Vaishyasi, you will come to me, you will come in me. You will become like in me. Me. So, one with me. So this is our conclusion.
Haribol.
Okay, so excellent. They presented seven clear verses, or more than that, in support of their point. Any counter-arguments, any rebuttals from anyone? Was, where, yeah.
Okay, that was extremely disingenuous of you. When you said the Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma, you should say the whole verse.
Yeah.
You can't say half the verse and half the chicken only. The, you know.
Krishna says, or the Lord, or the Brahman in the form of Krishna says that moksha ishyami, you will become liberated. So that's our liberation is our goal.
Yeah, but Krishna is a Brahman, he's para Brahman, there too.
And he also
where
says,
does he say, where does he say in the Gita? Where does he say?
So okay, good. That's one good rebuttal. Any other specific points they said? Not general arguments against Mayavad philosophy.
Into the 12th chapter, the 4th verse, Krishna says that Maya Vishya Manuye Mam Nitya Yukta Upasate Shrataya Pariyupasate Me Yukta Mam Me Yukta Mam Kumataha. The Supreme Personality of Godhead says, those who fix their mind on my personal form and are always engaged in worshipping me with a great and transcendental faith are considered by me the most perfect.
Right.
So in the previous verse, Arjuna was making a point that who is considered to be the more perfect, whether
right.
The impersonalist or the personalist. So Krishna is again making a point that who is the perfect are both of them.
Okay. So there's, yeah, Prabhu is pointing out chapter 12 where Krishna deals specifically with this problem. Namely, which is more important, the impersonal or the personal form. And Arjuna is confused and Krishna comes back and says, oh, you can reach both, but the personal form is more preferred by me, and it's easier. And the impersonal path is a lot more difficult. Right? Another problem with their argument is this assumption that Brahman, that Krishna is not Krishna. In other words, that there's someone within Krishna, or there's some force behind Krishna that needs to be worshipped or honored. Right? They didn't provide any evidence for the fact that the speaker is not the speaker, that there is someone else besides the speaker present there. Which is a sort of a typical move, is sort of taking the focus away from the speaker and saying we're talking about a generic principle. Prabhupada gives the example of if I say, bring me water, right? Then you say, oh, I and he are one, you take the water and drink it yourself. Right? So that's not proper, right? Because I ask for the water, I'm the speaker, so give it to me. So Krishna is saying, worship me, I'm the speaker, right? Give it to me.
Prabhu, one more. In the 4th chapter, verse 5, Sri Bhagavan Vajra, Bahume, Vyatitani, Janmani,
yes.
Arjuna.
Many, many births both you and I have taken. Right?
Yeah, then he's saying that I'm different than you there.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. I'm different than you, right? Many births you and I have taken,
yeah.
I remember all of them, you don't, right? It
so
shows difference.
If everything is one, then it can't be like that, right?
Another verse that Prabhupada points out in this regard is Natve Vaham Jatunasam. In chapter 2, Krishna says, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings. And Prabhupada says, if all of us existed as we are now, Prabhupada saying all these kings, right, then that means that there must be individuality. He's not saying at some point you didn't exist, but I existed because we were all one. Now, this is a very intelligent group. I'm sure they have counter-arguments to all these points. Chapter 12, for example, Bhagavad Gita, the verse you pointed out, impersonalists obviously know about those verses. And there's a variety of ways of getting around it. For one way is you just translate it a little differently, and you can say, Krishna's saying that the impersonal path is a lot more difficult, so it's for more intelligent and capable people. Whereas those who are a little stupid and foolish, they go for the easy path. So anyway, this argument is a long-standing one. It goes on for thousands of years. But thank you very much to both of these groups for their contribution. Very nice. Okay, we had one group, Bhakti here, right? Someone did Bhakti? Bhakti is supreme? Yeah, okay, devotional service. Spokesperson for that, devotional service group.
Don't put
the mic
this way.
Okay. Yeah, stand here. So everyone can see.
Okay. Are you off?
Is it off?
It's on.
Is it muted?
Okay, are you on?
Yes.
Okay, so our thesis was that bhakti is the highest. And for the introduction, we quoted verses 249, 250, and 251. And our reasoning was that Krishna in chapter 2 provides a summary of counter-arguments to Arjuna. So he goes through all these different counter-arguments. Like, don't worry, Arjuna, you won't incur sin if... you know, blah, 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 we're not the body. And then the final set of arguments that he gives is bhakti. So in essence, because Krishna's bringing up bhakti as the final argument, there's some weight or importance to that.
What verse was that?
249, 250, 251. It's kind of like the end of that section before Arjuna asks his next question about how does one like to sit or speak or, yeah. So in the conclusion, we also have verses 1864, 1855, 1866. So just like in verse 249, Krishna says that you should just surrender unto me. He also says that in the verses at the very end of the Gita, 1864, 1855, and 1866. What is repeated? There are a lot of examples, but we chose one very specific one, Manmanabha Madbhakto. Krishna repeats almost line to line the first half of the verse, as Prabhu was telling us about yesterday. And this you can see in chapter 9, which is the middle chapter of the Gita. So they say the best part of the sandwich is in the middle. And apparently that verse is also the exact very middle of the Gita itself. So it carries some importance there. And also Krishna says the very same thing at the end. For our third, what is new and original? We thought that the fact that Krishna was presenting that you can act and also perform bhakti as something revolutionary for the time, and you can read about that in chapter 12, verse 10. Krishna is saying that even if you can't perform the regulations of bhakti, you can work for me and still attain the highest goal of life. And that's pretty revolutionary, because in the context of the Gita during that time, there wasn't any such thing that you could work and do your duty and go back to Krishna. It was something that was kind of reserved for people going to the forest and this, that. So
this is what's new about the Gita.
Yes.
What category was this?
Yeah, the new and the original.
Okay, what was the verse number?
12:10.
12:10.
For results, we chose 9:22 as one of them, and I mentioned Bhantalam, which is if Krishna says, if you worship me and offer all
devotion, then I will give you what you lack.
And
these are what you have.
Yeah, exactly.
I repeat it in the mic.
Yeah.
Anandashchinta yantamam ye janaha paripasate tesham nityabhi yuktanam yoga kshema vahapeham. There he says that if you worship me in exclusive devotion, making me object of your service, then I preserve what you have and I give you what you lack.
For the next one, what Krishna is excited about, we chose verse again 934 and 1865 because of the repetition, and because Krishna spends a whole chapter explaining that bhakti is the most confidential knowledge, he really stretches that point at the beginning of chapter 2 and also at, chapter 9 and at the end of chapter 18, we reason that Krishna is pretty excited about bhakti. In terms of the argument and reasoning, the one thing that we thought of is Krishna really argues for bhakti being the easiest path. And he says that in Patram Pushpam Phalam Soyam, that's one example where he just says, even if you offer me water or fruit or flower with love. And what else? 647, I think?
647.
What was that one? And also verse chapter 12, verse 10 again, where Krishna says, even if you cannot attain the, or follow the regulations of bhakti, you can still come to me and attain the perfection of life. So, in short.
Wow, very good. So, as you can tell, for bhakti is the supreme, there's a lot there, right? There's no difficulty in terms of finding source material. Part of it, part of the reason is because we are so familiar with that thesis, so we know all the right verses as devotees. We don't know so many verses praising jnana, for example, or knowledge. But on the other hand, it's a fact that in Bhagavad Gita, there's no shortage of promotion of bhakti. This is something that's sort of accepted even outside the community of devotees here. Namely, most scholars of Bhagavad Gita agree that Bhagavad Gita is a synthetic text. It synthesizes many different ideas, Sankhya and Yoga and Karma and Jnana and Dhyana and so many different things Krishna brings together. But if you look at it objectively, most scholars agree that the Gita favors bhakti. So despite what the internal arguments we have, this is something that if you do an objective study of the Gita, it's just very hard to miss that emphasis on bhakti. In fact, looking at it from a historical point of view, Bhagavad Gita is the first time in Vedic literature where bhakti is really emerges as the main point. In other words, if you look at the Upanishads, then the primary focus is knowledge, know yourself, right? And to prove impersonal points is much easier from the Upanishads than it is from Bhagavad Gita. If you go to the Vedas, a lot of emphasis on karma in terms of do right sacrifices, right performances. Not so much about bhakti. Something is there, but not so much. So Bhagavad Gita is really sort of the first time where bhakti becomes the strongest point. And so it's a very reasonable point to make. You know, it's not something that we necessarily have to struggle for, to say that bhakti is the primary intent of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, in terms of their presentation, a couple of areas that were a little weak that maybe we could strengthen a little more. One was the introductory verse. It was 249. So it's getting a little bit late in the Bhagavad Gita. Okay, it's still chapter 2, but Krishna began his instruction in chapter 2 with verse number 11. That's sort of the latest you can say is the start of Bhagavad Gita. So we're talking about another already 45 verses after that. Is there any suggestion we might offer for something a little bit earlier in the Gita that still makes the point about bhakti in some good way? Anything before 249 that you might think of?
240.
Hmm?
214,
which is?
40.
40, okay. A little bit better. 240. Neha vikrama nashosti pratyavayo navidyate svalpam apyasya dharmasya trayate mahatube. There's no loss or diminution on this path. Even a little advancement can save one from the greatest type of fear. The problem with that verse is it doesn't actually talk about bhakti as the path. On this path could mean Sankhya, for example, which is what Krishna talked about in the last verse. Yes?
So our group had a theme, become a devotee, which is the sister theme of this, yes. Bhakti. And so, you know, instead of going to the second chapter, we said, we looked at the book as a whole, and one of us came up with this idea that you know, we were searching for Krishna's verses, like verses spoken by him. But then we said, no, let's approach this book as the author, Srila Prabhupada,
okay,
wrote it. And therefore, we looked at the introduction. And then throughout the introduction, but specifically on pages 4 and 32, Prabhupada specifically talks about the importance of becoming a devotee, being, you know, being a bhakta. And so that could be a theme that's...
Okay.
But that's
Prabhupada.
Okay. But it's the beginning of the book.
Okay, there's some, the approach here was to say the beginning of the book means this book here, so let's look at the introduction by Srila Prabhupada. There were some disagreements with that. Who was shaking their head in the back? Venkat Prabhu? You were shaking your head, no? I just know your name, so that's why I'm calling on you.
Sense, I can counter that argument by bringing another edition of the Gita, which has, you know, an introduction by, you know, whoever, Aurobindo or Gandhi, that says something quite different.
Right.
And then we're really debating commentaries rather than the
actual right.
text.
Right.
We need to go to the primary source.
Okay, so good. So if the task was to prove what the main point of Prabhupada's Gita is, then your approach would work, right? Now, to show the main point of Prabhupada's Gita is not so difficult. Because Prabhupada, he also said this many times. He said, I've written my Gita in such a way that even a fool won't miss the point. Right? You see the way Prabhupada writes his purport. It's sort of like, do you get it? Do you get it? Okay, here it is again. Here it comes again. Right? Because Prabhupada wanted to make it crystal clear what the main point was. Now, we have the benefit of working with Prabhupada's Gita. If you didn't, if we were working with the primary text, the main source that everyone disagrees about, what's a verse that you might use to support the thesis of bhakti? Madan Gopal?
Yeah, no, we tried to look as early as possible. We went towards the end of chapter 2, and then we, you know, when you came and clarified, it's very hard in the beginning to find a direct, you know, our point was surrender to Krishna. So then we went to Karpanya Dosha where Arjuna surrenders. Now we're looking at the book, but Krishna is not speaking. It's Arjuna is speaking, but he says, "Tapane dosho, that I'm now surrendering unto you, right? Shishyasteyam shadimam swam prapannam." So prapannam is a surrender, and because surrender is like the turning point, the Gita starts here, actually. You can say that now Arjuna is no more friendly talk, and this point is actually formal instruction as a guru disciple, so you can call this the introduction. You can even call it the starting point. Before that, I was studying the field, and it starts with surrender, and surrender is the basis or the main thing for bhakti.
Okay, so there's a good possibility, right? That 2.7, it's not Krishna speaking, but it is part of the Bhagavad Gita, and you could argue that it's in fact a very important part of the Gita, because if that verse were not spoken, the whole Gita would not be spoken, right? So bhakti is the whole reason that the Gita was spoken, because someone had bhakti in their heart. Someone had a desire to at least seek refuge, to surrender to the Lord. Okay? So that's one option. The second verse that I think we could strengthen a little bit is their choice of what's original or novelty in Bhagavad Gita. They chose verse chapter 12, verse number 10, I think, right? That was a very important verse where Krishna says, if you can't do this, then do this, right? It was a gradation verse. And it's a very useful verse for the other category that they used it for. They used it for two categories. If you cannot practice the regulations of Bhakti Yoga, then just try to work for me, because by working for me, you will come to the perfect stage. Okay. Is there any statement in the Gita where Krishna says that I'm giving you something new or original, which is bhakti, right? Where there's some devotional sense to it, where he makes a clear statement that this is the gift I'm giving you of bhakti is something that's new or unique or special?
934. The most confidential.
934. Manmanabhava Magga. But the verse doesn't say that this is the most confidential.
Okay.
Yeah. Rajavidya Raja Guhyam. Okay. You could use that one. And use that in conjunction with Manmanabhava Magga, right? So the ninth chapter begins by saying, this is the most confidential. This is the most secret. And it then ends with the idea that become my devotee. Right? So you can sort of combine two verses there and say, look, this is giving the most secret. Or Krishna says in 1865 or 4, he says, now hear my supreme instruction, the most secret of all secrets. Secret means it's original, right? If it's the most secret of all secrets, very few people have heard it. The most secret of all secrets. Ishto sime dridamiti. I'm telling you this because I love you so much. He says, I'm telling you this because you are so dear to me. And again, that signifies the relationship of bhakti. Right there.
64.
Yeah. So you can really, for the theme of bhakti or surrender unto me, you can really make this very, very strong. If you really take the time, we didn't have much time, but to choose just the right verses and the argument, it can become a very powerful, very solid argument. You don't have to beat around the bush at all. Okay. Yes?
So this idea that Krishna is saying, you know, I'm sharing this with you because you're so dear to me, if we take that as an indicator of bhakti, then in a certain way, I think you can make an argument that as early as Krishna's first appearance in the Gita, I mean, it's not explicitly in the text, but what is explicitly in the text is that he's driving Arjuna's chariot, and he's addressed as Achyuta, and I guess you have to go into a little commentary, but one common understanding of Achyuta is he never fails in his taking care of his devotees and his servants and his devotees. And then that shows up again in the conclusion. Krishna is, you know, I'll take care of you. So this theme of Krishna's caring, if you look at that as bhakti, then I think you can make an argument that as early as the first time Krishna appears in the Gita.
Okay, there you go. That's an excellent suggestion. You may not even have to focus just on Achyuta. As you were saying, just taking the idea of Krishna as chariot driver, where Arjuna says, take my chariot to the middle, and Krishna says, okay, I'm taking it there. That in itself can be seen as an indicator of affectionate relationship, which is the basis of the whole speaking of the Gita, is that connection between Krishna and Arjuna. So there's a number of ways that you can build this argument and make it quite strong. So excellent job. Thank you very much. That was very well. Okay, so I'm going to leave it to these two groups. I'm sorry there's so many groups, and I heard so many good ideas from all of you. I think I had a chance to visit most of the groups. And you had very, very solid arguments, both positive and negative ones. And I hope it was an opportunity that you can continue using in the future, is sort of systematic study of the Gita that takes the whole Gita into account. This was something we were talking about yesterday also, is when we do systematic study of something, we tend to break it into its tiniest parts, right? Let's look at the word sarva dharma, right? And let's just focus on that. Let's talk for an hour on that. So that's good for analysis. But when we try to understand the meaning of the Gita, it's also good to take it as a whole. And that's part of the reason for this exercise. You've got 6 or 7 different categories, and you have to find their source material throughout the entire Bhagavad Gita. If all the verses you found come from one chapter, your argument's looking very risky. Right? You've proven the main point of chapter 9, but not beyond that. On the other hand, if you're not able to find something at the beginning of the Gita, well, you have to rethink, right? So it forces you to think of the Gita as a whole text, as a complete work, and ask, does the Gita actually have a common point? Maybe it doesn't, right? Someone could argue that it's just a confused book and it has so many different points in it. But we accept that, no, it does have a single point. So then we should be able to find it across the entire book. In the middle of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Jnanir pat maiva me matam. He says, the jnani is like my very own self. He's the best of all of them. What do you do with a verse like that? When Krishna says, of all of them, the jnani is my very favorite. Do we say that he's better than the bhakta? So we have to go back to that chapter. And if you read that chapter, you'll see that the argument's not so cut and dry. It's not so clean. On the other hand, sometimes the verses we do quote, we don't realize. If you read them in context, those verses are twice as powerful than we might think they originally are. They're twice as powerful. Like this verse, Yoginam Api Sarvesham, in chapter 6.
What's
47. Krishna says, we quote this verse a lot. Yoginam api sarvesham madgate nantaratmana shraddhavan bhajate yomam same yukta tamomata. Of all different yogis, the one who surrenders to me, loves me, he's the best of them all. We quote it so much, right? But the context of the verse makes it even more powerful. Why? Where is it coming? Krishna has just described a different form of yoga. Dhyana yoga, meditation. Sit up straight, stare at the tip of your nose, half close your eyes, and so on. And Arjun has rejected that form of yoga, or said, he's very nervous about it. Not exactly rejected, but he said, I don't know if I can do it. Krishna's pushed back and said, no, you can if you practice. Arjun's pushed back again and said, okay, what's going to happen if I fail? Will I go to hell? Will I be lost? Krishna says, no, no, don't worry. You'll come back in a good family and you can continue your practice of yoga. And after he says that, right, then he says, Arjun, look, it's worth trying. Why? Because the yogi is better than the ascetic. Tapasvibhyadiko yogi, he says. He's better than the jnani. He's better than the karmi. Karmibhyopchadiko yogi. Tasmad yogi bhavajana. That's why you should be a yogi. Just the previous verse, Krishna says, he's better than the ascetic, better than the jnani, better than the karmi. Right? All three categories. And then he turns around and says, of all the yogis, my devotee is the best. So, to an Arjun who's so nervous about losing his way, Krishna says, you gotta be a yogi. Okay, fine. If you can't do the meditation type, just become my devotee. Right? Things will be fine. That makes that verse so much more powerful, right? If you understand where it's coming, if you just know the previous verse, it makes it twice as powerful. Because Krishna deletes all other processes and says, oh, forget about karma, oh, forget about tapasya, oh, forget about jnani, just be a yogi. Oh, what kind of yogi? Be my devotee. That's powerful, very powerful. So context is very crucial, very important. Whatever verses we know, we think we know by heart, go back and say, what's the context of that verse? If we know this verse, patram pushpam phalam poem, what's the context? What's coming right before it? What's coming right after it? Sarva dharman parityaja. What's Krishna just said right before sarva dharman parityaja? Or six verses before? Do we realize the fact that when Krishna says sarva dharman parityaja, he's already closed Bhagavad Gita? Krishna's already said, I'm done. He said, everything I wanted to tell you is over now. Gita is finished. And then he comes back and says, oh, by the way, I still had one more thing to tell you. Why don't you give up everything and surrender to me? That's powerful, isn't it? If this was just part of the flow of Bhagavad Gita, you'd think, oh, it's just one more verse. But Krishna actually closes things. He says, that beautiful verse, do as you please, it's there. He says, thus I have explained to you knowledge still more confidential. Deliberate on this fully and then do what you wish to do. 1863. It's the end. He said, I've told you everything I wanted to tell you. Now do as you like. Right? Yathechasi tathakuru. And then Krishna says, like a concerned parent, right? He says, but just in case you missed what I think you should do, here it is again. So he says, do whatever you want. I've told you everything. You're a responsible adult, Arjun. You think about all this. Vimishaita. Think about it fully. And then do what you think is best. Oh, but in case you forgot what I said, what I think you should do, here it is again. Just like parents. They say, oh, you're grown up now. You're old enough. Now you go do your own thing, right? I'm here for advice if you need me. But then they can't help it. Yeah. When they see something, the don't do that. Why are you doing that? So Krishna's doing the same thing. He loves Arjun so much, and that's he said that already. He loves Arjun so much, he's saying, look, here, let me just repeat what I said earlier, in case you missed it. And let me add one more thing to that. which is just forget about all of this. Surrender to it. That makes the verse so much more powerful. If you know where it's coming in 18th chapter, instead of just what it's saying. So go back to every verse that you know from Gita and think about its context. Think about its context. And when you know the context for every verse, then you really know those verses. Then you know what Krishna is really saying in those verses. Okay. Any questions at this point, after this exercise and so on, that you have? Yes?
It says in 225, It is said that the soul is invisible, inconceivable, immutable. Knowing this, you should not grieve for the body. So if the soul is immutable, it sort of says that it has no form, right? Or shape. And then Krishna says, I am sort of your soul, you. So then does that mean that, you know, Krishna has no form? That's the question that comes to mind.
Yeah, so the question is, if in chapter 2, Krishna says, the soul is invisible, it's immutable, it's unchangeable, and it's very difficult to know this spirit soul, right? So the question is, okay, if Krishna is the soul in all beings, then does this mean Krishna is formless and he's invisible and so on? So it's a good question. Krishna in chapter 2, he's discussing the individual Atma present in all living beings. Himself, he discusses later on in Bhagavad Gita. In other words, the Upanishads and Gita itself, they describe, they talk about how there's two beings within the heart, not one. There's us, the individual soul, and there's Paramatma. There's the Atma and the Paramatma. Paramatma Krishna defines later in Bhagavad Gita. He says, how does that verse go? Bharta Bhokta Maheshwara, he says. O Upadrashta Anumantacha Bharta Bhokta Maheshwara Paramatmeti Chapyukto Dehismin Purushapara. He defines what is Paramatma and defines it very differently. He says, Upadrashta Anumantacha, one who is observing everything and giving permission. Bharta, who is the supporter, Bhokta, the enjoyer. So it's none of this, he's invisible and he's silent and no. He's very much active in that role. It is the super soul within our heart, guiding all living beings. So there's two beings, two birds on the same tree. The individual and the super soul. Yes?
You mentioned that this technique was invented maybe like 2,000 years back.
Yes.
So in that case, this chaturshloki from this Bhagavad Gita, was it done like 2,000 years back or was it always chaturshloki?
No, the technique itself, it's not connected to Bhagavad Gita at all. Okay, this technique, it was done by the Mimamsakas. So the question was, this technique that we just practiced, it came 2,000 years ago. So using that technique, did they find these four chaturshloki as the essence of Bhagavad Gita? And this, what I was saying is this technique is something that was used much before even the Vaishnava Sampradayas that we know of. It was used by the Mimamsakas. And the Mimamsakas were the philosophers that Krishna presents when he's in Govardhan Lila, where he says, karma is the only thing you have to do. And even the demigods are dependent on your karma. So that they were all about doing the Vedic rituals properly. And in order to do the Vedic rituals properly, they needed to figure out exactly what the Vedas are saying, precisely, every word of it. So they figured out this whole technique of explaining the meaning of the Veda. And so they were so good at it that after them, even all their opponents, they used their technique because they were so good at creating these techniques to defeat their points. So Shankaracharya, Ramanujacharya, they disagree with the Mimamsakas. Most of the Vedantists, they disagree. They say that no, karma is not the main point. It's jnana or it's bhakti. But their techniques were so good that they all used their techniques for the same purpose. So Shankaracharya uses this technique to prove that tattvam asi, I am him, Brahman, right? So his impersonalist point, like this group did, right? So Shankaracharya uses the technique to prove that tattvam asi is the main point of the Upanishads. Madhvacharya uses this point to prove his point, that we are different from the Lord. And Jiva Goswami uses this technique to prove that Bhagavan, the personal form of the Lord, is the main point of Srimad Bhagavatam. So all the different acharyas, they use these techniques to establish their particular points. It's quite an ancient, quite a wonderful technique. So in conclusion, what I want to do, just looking forward to tomorrow's seminar, is just read the next two verses, so you have a little bit of a taste. Now, these three verses are all very closely related together. So it comes very naturally, sort of in one session, tomorrow's two-hour session. In the first verse that we talked about today, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo, Matta Sarvam Prabhadade, Krishna says, I'm the source of everything, right? And he ends by saying, one who knows this, loves me, or worships me with all his heart. Buddha Bhava Samanvita. So the question that arises is, okay, what does that mean? Loving Krishna with all your heart. How do you do that? So in the next verse, Krishna explains, Machitta Madgarta Prana Bodhayanta Paraspara Kathayantascha Mam Nityam Tushyanticha Ramanticha. That one who really loves me, how do you tell? I could say, I really love Krishna with all my heart. What does that mean? He says, Machitta, his mind is completely dedicated to me. Madgata prana, his whole life is invested in me. Bodhayanta paraspara, and he spends his time, or she spends her time, with other devotees, discussing my glories. Bodhayanta paraspara. Kathayantascha mam nityam, always glorifying me. Tushyanti cha ramanti cha, joyful and happy. One of the questions we're going to raise tomorrow, okay, this is just a little trailer here, a little taster, is to say, okay, so a devotee is always thinking about Krishna. First, what does always mean? Does it mean I can do nothing else? And if I can do other things, then what does it mean by saying always, right? How do I incorporate Krishna into every aspect of my life? Second thing you could ask is, Tushyanti cha ramanti cha, the devotees are always happy doing this. Well, not always, right? Means, what about suffering in the life of a devotee? Krishna, it seems like he's painting a very perfect picture here. Right? Everything's very nice in the life of a devotee. But what happens in times of difficulty? Right? When they don't have the opportunity to please one another by glorifying Krishna. What about Vibhishan in Lanka, for example? Right? So like that. Then, what happens when you do this kind of exchange, what takes place? Krishna describes now his role. He says, Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam yenamam upayantite. To someone who does this all the time, again, satata yuktanam, who's worshipping me priti purvakam, with love, I give them the understanding, dadami buddhi yogam tam yenamam upayantite, by which they can come to me. So Krishna is giving them the knowledge by which we can come to Krishna. So, returning to Krishna. And then the last verse is very beautiful. Tesham evanukampartham aham ajnana jamtama nashayam yatma bhavasto jnana dipena bhasva. I destroy ignorance from their hearts altogether, like the lamp of knowledge. Why? Anukampa. Out of mercy for me. Not for me, for them. Right? Out of mercy, compassion. This word anukampa in Sanskrit is beautiful. Kampa, you know what kampa means? It means to tremble. Or to feel pain. Kampana, in Hindi we say kampana, right? To tremble. Anukampa means to tremble with someone. Means in English we say empathy, right? Empathy. To feel someone else's pain. Right? That's anukampa. So that's why it's mercy. If someone's homeless and I feel their pain, right? So I do something about it. I want to help them. So Krishna is saying, I feel your pain. I suffer with you. I'm trembling with you. Right?
Oh, what verse is that?
This is the last verse, 11. 10, 11. Deshame vanu gampa. So the question here that naturally arises is, what does Krishna know of our pain? He says, I'm suffering with you. Right? I feel your pain. But does he really? When's the last time Krishna suffered? When did he actually feel pain? Can he really tremble with us?
Yeah,
is the super soul suffering?
No, he feels the pain.
So he's suffering. Anyway, so this is the question, right? This is the question. Does the Lord suffer? And how does he know who we are, right? And how we're suffering. So this is what's on schedule for tomorrow from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock, right? Yeah, 2 to 4? 3 to 5. Okay. 3 to 5 tomorrow. And then we have our regular Sunday feast, okay, in a Sunday feast lecture. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you all very much for your attention. First time in history, we ended early.
You're a little exhausted by now. You're probably tired, right?
Yeah, I try to avoid here than after.
After, yeah. Well, seminar is kind of draining.
It's been sort of 4 hours, you know.
No, it's true.